Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Michael Findley earned a PhD in the Anthropology of Education program at the University of Oregon. He has over 30 years teaching, including students at Chico State University and Butte College. In 2013, he was named Educator of the Year by the Chico Rotary Association. He is currently a professor at Butte College, where he has worked for over 20 years. In 2018, he published Cultural Traditions of Ancient Mesoamerica. In 2016, he published A Survey of Language and Culture, Linguistic Anthropology, and Cross-Cultural Communication. Michael Findley, welcome.
Oh, thank you. Nice to be here.
Your last book is quite a mouthful.
Yeah, it is.
But I did want to talk to you about this book with the really long title, even though it isn't your most recent book, because I find it fascinating, just the title of it. And the reason I wanted to talk to you is I happen to be at the bookstore. There's a place called the bookstore here in town. And I happened to be in there talking to a young man who worked there. And as we were talking, he said, boy, I had this great course at Butte College.
Oh, that's great.
And when he told me the name of it, I said, that really does sound interesting. So I was talking to a fan of yours, and that is why I wanted to invite you in to talk about this survey of language and culture.
Oh, that's nice to hear. Yeah.
So this is your textbook, right?
This is the text, yeah, that I used in Anthropology 14, and it's a lower division text. I used to teach the upper division class at CSU Chico, and I did that for quite a number of years. But when I went to Butte, I wanted to have a book that worked for lower division, college freshmen, sophomores, hearing this stuff for the first time.
So if you need a text, you wrote it yourself.
I wrote it myself. That's correct.
Well, I do want to get back to that, but I noticed that you, up until last fall, lived in Paradise.
That's right, yes.
And I wondered if, as an anthropologist, you had a special perspective on what happened in November of last year.
Well, we were home on November 8th when the sky got kind of dark, and we left, and we barely got out. There was fire on either side. And when we went back up to the house.
You mean sometime later?
Yeah, sometime much later when we could get back up there. As an anthropologist, one of the things that struck me was that this would not happen to hunter-gatherers. They just wouldn't accumulate all this stuff. And it helped me a little bit, but it was also a very sad thing to stand there and look at. Once was our house and our library and all of my wife's family pictures and heirlooms, family heirlooms, all that was gone.
So you were home that morning when the fire broke.
We were home, yeah.
And you, I guess, evacuated.
We evacuated. We didn't get an evacuation notice. We were waiting for it, and that caused us to wait a bit too long. But I don't think anyone's to blame for that. The fire moved so fast.
Yeah, who could have possibly anticipated a fire like that?
Yeah. When we heard that there was a fire, it was 25 miles away. And this is a story you're going to hear over and over again from people that lived in various places in within Paradise.
Did you have animals?
No. Our cat of 18 years had passed away a couple of years before that. So it was just my wife and I.
Well, that's an added stressor to a lot of people that they have animals to care for.
And oh, it is. It is. Yeah.
So you, as an anthropologist, say, well, if we had been hunter-gatherers, we wouldn't have had anything to lose. We just had to save ourselves.
Yeah. Nomadic hunter-gatherers can't afford to accumulate lots of stuff because they have to move constantly to make a living. But we've been sedentary for thousands of years, and so we've fallen into that pattern. And unfortunately, when disaster strikes, everything can go. I mean, there's the potential for that kind of calamity.
Well, you mentioned hunter-gatherers because you have studied some very ancient cultures. And what in particular, what cultures did you study? Because I mentioned the title of your 2018 book was Cultural Traditions of Ancient Mesoamerica.
Yeah, that is a textbook that covers mainly pre-contact Mesoamerican traditions like the Maya, the Olmec, Aztecs, Mixtec, Zapotec, so forth. And then I have towards the end of the book information on post-contact colonialism and the conquest. And so those are the themes associated with that. For my dissertation study, I did an ethnographic research project looking at Hmong high school students.
Yes, I noticed that because a lot of your work was, say, in Mesoamerica, and yet there was your work with Hmong culture.
That's right, yeah.
How did you make that leap?
Well, those interests developed kind of simultaneously. I think the interest in Mesoamerica goes further back in my own personal history. I was interested in that that area, even going back to high school. But when I was in graduate school, I became interested in cultural adaptation and looking at how people from different cultural perspectives adapt to one another. And so I became interested in Southeast Asia and Southeast Asian history. And then we had Hmong here in California.
And here in Chico.
So I wanted to find out what they were going through. And that involved a lot of linguistic analysis because a lot of cultural adaptation is how people interact face to face. And most people have kind of uninformed, naive views of language process. And so I wanted to make use of the methods that linguistic anthropologists and sociolinguists use to kind of coax out some of the nuances in terms of how people coming from different cultural and linguistic backgrounds deal with one another, basically.
Because in the case of the Hmongs, it's not just a difference in language, like somebody from Europe comes over and maybe they're German speaking,
right.
But culturally, they don't have the jolt, the shock that somebody coming from such a different culture as the Hmongs do.
Yeah, I think that's true.
So what did you learn?
Oh, I learned all kinds of things. I learned that through language contact, the Hmong language is actually changing.
Due to its influence here?
Due to its contact with English speakers, mainly. And this is an age-old process. English went through that when they came into contact with Norse speakers in the north of England and then all over the world, actually.
In fact, I always think of when the English and the Normans came in, and that's why we have different words for the pig that's out there on four legs and the pork that's on our plate.
That's right. And then there are quite a few French terms in the English lexicon because we were conquered by the French-speaking world in 1060. But with Hmong, some of it's generational. I'd have to get into a technical discussion of Hmong, and I don't want to do too much of that, but they had what are called noun classifiers, and they had well over 100 of them. So noun classifiers are a little bit like articles. They come right before nouns, but it marks a class of nouns, so like tools, houses.
So the article in front of the noun, you can tell whether it's a tool or
what. Yeah, the nouns fall into semantic categories. Well, Hmong doesn't have noun classifiers for things like computers, academic disciplines, and so young Hmong speakers had to kind of search around for something that would fit these new noun categories. And so what they did was they just went with the default classifiers, the classifiers that work for kind of nondescript round things. And their parents and their grandparents were getting kind of frustrated with them. But that's the way a language will change within one generation. And all languages go through that when they have contact with other languages and other people and other societies. So it's not just the language, but it's those items, too, that were forcing the linguistic changes. So that fits right in with the theme of language and culture.
My guest is Professor Michael Findlay, and he teaches at Dubuque College. He's been teaching there for over 20 years, and he has books on cultural traditions and language, linguistic anthropology. And we were just talking about the Hmongs because those languages are so different. Most of us here, students in college, study European language typically. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes think we don't even imagine how different languages can be if we're only familiar with European languages. For example, I'm curious, I don't know anything about the Hmong language, but I would wonder, well, does it have grammatical gender? Does it have, like our language has a singular and plural. You either have one book or two books. But I know Sanskrit, for example, has three. You can have one, two, or more. So what differences does the Hmong language have that we would never even imagine?
Well, there's quite a range of variation in terms of the world's languages. Pronouns in Hmong, for example, are not gender marked. They're neutral. And so that's what
we don't have that problem of he or she or how do
well,
we
Well, you don't have that. They didn't have that problem. But also when translation occurs or when they're interpreting something, that's what we call a transfer issue. It doesn't transfer well into English. And it's the same for some other Asian languages like Mandarin and others. So you'll hear people search around for the right pronoun, and if they don't have the linguistic model that fits, they can make mistakes. So it's just part of the language acquisition process. People eventually kind of figure it out.
But that's what I find fascinating. When I listen to somebody whose first language is Chinese, and I hear them struggling with, like you were just talking about, the pronouns, and I realize, oh, there's a difference in Chinese, say Mandarin,
yeah,
from English.
Yeah, and many of the Asian languages are tonal. Which a lot of people aren't sure what that means. It means the tone that comes in the final position of a word actually changes the semantic attribute of the word. It's not being sarcastic or anything like that. And so, for example, Hmong speakers hearing English speakers when they're communicating sarcasm as opposed to just being polite or something like that, have trouble picking up on those cues. And so that's another transfer issue that doesn't go well. Some other languages, to kind of jump outside of the Hmong thing, often in spatial referencing, won't include themselves as speakers in the utterance that is used to reference objects around them. So, for example, among the Australian Aborigines, there's no ego-centered spatial referencing. So if they're pointing to an object behind them, like a mountain or a bush or something like that, they would point to themselves, and we would assume that they're pointing at themselves when in fact they're not. They're kind of linguistically invisible. And so those kinds of things can throw people off, you know, in terms of how you translate from one language to another. So that's why in linguistic anthropology, we take the time to kind of coax out those structural differences in languages.
Well, it's so often more than just this word means this in this language. I remember in China, our guide said, we pointed out a green house.
Mm-hmm.
What we would expect, here's a house painted green. But you probably know he meant a greenhouse.
Yeah. Yeah, those kinds of things can be confusing. You know, you mentioned the word house. When in English we hear the word house, it also carries the connotative meaning of a home. But that's not necessarily always the case. And so in some languages, they may differentiate between the raw descriptive term for a house. In Maya, it would be na. And then if they say utut, they mean a dwelling that is a home. But you have to know that, you see.
My guest is anthropologist Michael Findlay, and we're talking about cross-cultural communication. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman.
Thank you.
I'm back with my guest, Michael Findlay. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Professor Findlay has studied ancient cultures and languages and cross-cultural communication. And he teaches at Butte College. He's been teaching there for over 20 years. And his book that I've been asking him about, A Survey of Language and Culture, Linguistic Anthropology and Cross-Cultural Communication. And since you have studied the Hmong language, I'm not assuming that you can speak it. You know a lot about it, but can you communicate in Hmong?
For a while, I had a kind of low-level fluency in it, and so I know phrases. I can, kind of a pidgin Hmong that I use. But it was things happened where, as I was starting to gain some fluency, other things happened in my life, and I kind of regret not having to be able to get down and really develop some fluency in it.
Well, maybe we shouldn't assume that people are familiar with this culture because it's not something that, say, we typically interact with. Now, maybe the farmer's market. But tell us a little bit about where the Hmong who are here, where did they come from?
Originally, they seem to be part of a set of populations in central China. And there are close to 8 million Hmongic speakers still in China, speaking different varieties of Hmong. But the Hmong that are here in the U.S. Originally came from Laos and got caught up in the what most historians still call the Vietnam War, but a lot of historians now refer to it as the Second Indochina War because it involved Laos and Cambodia. And for the most part, the Hmong sided with the U.S. and became targets of the Pathet Lao government, and they forced them out, and their exodus took them to refugee camps in Thailand, camps like Ban Vanai and other camps. And then eventually, with refugee status, they moved to the U.S., to France, some to Australia. And so starting in the late 1970s and throughout the 1980s, the U.S. received a significant population of Hmong. I think I'm trying to remember the figures. It wasn't a huge migration, but these were people that had basically sided with us in the war, and so they've had a tough go of it, and they faced a lot of discrimination once they got here as well.
Well, you study culture because it's not really possible to learn a language without learning the culture. Because some word, if you look up a word in the dictionary, you don't always know, well, is this a word that you could use in proper society? Is this something an educated person would use? I have a friend who gets frustrated that he's an educated person in his own culture when he speaks English, and yet his foreign language that he tries to speak is not at that level. And I wonder if you encounter that when you were looking at these cross-cultural communications, these
Well, that's a big part of linguistic anthropology is, most people, I think, have the naive assumption that words are autonomous. You just go to – they'll even say the dictionary instead of a dictionary and look them up. And dictionaries are useful. They're useful for spelling conventions and getting a handle on a core definition. But so much of what is communicated goes beyond just core definitions of words. And there really sometimes is no clear understanding as to what a core definition is. So one of the examples I like to use in class is you can run to a dictionary and look up the word house. We were talking about house before. But if you take Abraham Lincoln's quote, a house divided unto itself cannot stand, you're going to have trouble understanding what he was trying to get at. And so most meaning is communicated subtextually or through connotative meaning. And then we make great use of metaphors. And sometimes it's very difficult to figure out whether someone is speaking metaphorically or just plain old descriptively, just being straightforward. And you'll hear people say, well, can't you just say what you mean? And these are the same people that will make use of metaphors without even knowing it. they're speaking abstractly.
Well, I can just imagine that this is something that since you were a little kid, you were probably interested in this. I don't know whether it's really anthropology or languages. When did you recognize that this was something that interested you?
Well, I really consciously became aware of the fact that I wanted to study this as an undergraduate in college. But growing up in my family, both my parents went to school in Mexico City using their GI bills. And so my father kind of minored in anthropology. He worked in the area of international business law, but his minor was in anthropology. So I heard lots of stories growing up about the Maya and the Aztecs and the Mixtec.
Well, then I'm sure you've been to that fantastic museum in Mexico City.
Well, we've been there a number of times.
The Museum of Anthropology. Oh, my
God. Yeah, that's really something. That's quite a place.
It is, indeed. So you grew up then with a curiosity piqued by what you were surrounded with when you were growing up.
Yeah, I think without knowing it, both my mother and father planted some of those seeds in me. And then when I started to, you know, when you're an undergraduate, you're kind of taking this class and that class, then all of a sudden you're in a class where you're going, yeah, I like this, you know. And so it started to build that way until I was a history major as an undergraduate with a minor in anthropology. But then when I decided to go to grad school, I switched to anthropology.
Well, I can just imagine, because you mentioned the Maya, you're taking a trip out to the Yucatan Peninsula, for example, mm-hmm. and that must have stirred your curiosity, too, looking at all the structures that are still there, some of them rubble,
right,
and have been built over, but you must have been very curious about who were these people.
Yeah, I was, and they're still there. I mean, there's still close to 8 million Maya down there speaking different varieties of Maya. And we're going down there in January again, and we've been down there numerous times, but we're flying into Merida, and we're going to spend 10 days with the Archaeological Conservancy going around to various sites, including some sites that we haven't been to before. So we're really looking forward to that.
Have you ever been on a site yourself actually doing the digging?
Oh, I started out doing archaeology, but it was here in California. But I have been on sites down in Mesoamerica when other people have been working on them, but those excavations, they're kind of territorial. You can join a field class, though. Anyone can do that and go down.
Well, there's an anthropologist who is afraid that our what could be excavated are being looted,
yeah,
and that by, I think, the year 2040, she said, we're not going to be able to, all these sites are going to be destroyed. And she has a way of seeing where these excavation sites are without actually digging.
That's a big problem, and it's been a big problem for years. And it's a complicated problem because we tend to focus on the looters, but they're selling that stuff to collectors up here, even to museums, and some museums are considered to be respectable, but the laws are becoming, well, they were becoming stricter. Now there are some issues. But recently, with the use of LIDAR, which is a remote sensing technology, they're able to get more accurate and more detailed maps of particular areas, particularly areas where there's a lot of a rainforest cover. And so we now know that the Maya infrastructure is much larger than we thought. And Tom Garrison is one of the archaeologists leading some of that. And I was in a workshop a few years ago in Austin, Texas, where they made us sign a non-disclosure agreement because we were getting data from LIDAR that was like 2 days old. And here are these experts who had been in the field just weeks before looking at the same sites that they were working on. And I remember one of them commenting, they pointed at the map, and he goes, that's a new looter's trench. He goes, that has gone in within the last 5-6 days. So and one of the other things that they said, which kind of lingered in my mind, he said, nowadays it's more sophisticated because looters have computers. And so that's why they didn't want their data out. And so they're very protective of that because the looters can look up on their computers and find new sites and then go to them and start to do their work.
Well, some years ago in Peru, when I would visit families, some of them had their own kind of museum of artifacts that they had gotten.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I just imagine the storehouse of treasures, archaeological treasures that must have existed if all these people have these collections themselves, plus the museums that have their own collections.
Well, part of it is an education problem because most people just think you see a projectile point on the ground, you pick it up, you take it home. The people have their own private collections. Most kids around here probably have projectile point collections and other things. But when it becomes big business, we can tackle that with some education, pointing out that these collections, if they're just taken out of the ground without being measured in, without any scientific controls, are not that useful in terms of information. And we were in a museum in Oaxaca City a few years ago, and I would say about 80% of the artifacts in this museum, which was built up by a personal family, a family that lived there in Oaxaca, didn't have scientific controls attached to the artifacts. They were what we call unprovenienced. But they're nice to look at, and they're fancy and interesting, but they've lost pretty much their scientific value when that happens.
Well, technology has sped up this process because when I was in Peru, people that like on the coast or along the coast where there was just sand would take a long pole and poke it in the ground as they went along. And then when they found when the pole went down without resistance, they, oh, there's a tomb, a grave there.
Yeah.
And then they would dig for potteries, one of the main things that they would find there.
Yeah, they have a lot of different forms of technology that they use, ground penetrating radar, remote sensing coming from satellites as well. The LIDAR tends to be from planes that fly over, and just like you would do a survey on the ground, they're doing it in a plane above an area and flying in transects and all that. But there's a lot of technology, but a lot of it is just still the old-fashioned get out there on the ground and do what we call ground proofing. You know, where you can see something from a remote through a remote venue, but if you can't figure out on the ground what it is, it's still not you can't assess what it is until you see it.
My guest is anthropologist Michael Findlay. He teaches at Butte College, and he wrote a book, A Survey of Language and Culture, Linguistic Anthropology and Cross-Cultural Communication. And we've mentioned you've studied Hmong, their culture and language, and Mesoamerica, mm-hmm. Mayas. What other fields have you taken a close look at?
Well, I'm currently working on a paper that focuses on Upper Paleolithic European cave painting. And I became interested in that a long time ago because it deals with symbolic patterns and so forth. So, it just kind of was a natural fit with linguistics, even though we don't have Upper Paleolithic people around to interview anymore. But last year we went to Europe and went through that area in France, in Sarlat, and visited some of the cave sites there. And I wrote a little introductory paper for some friends of ours that were with us. And as I was doing that, it occurred to me that because these painting scenes, these scenes in places in Europe, like Lascaux and others, rarely show human figures. And so that whole issue of spatial referencing and all that kind of came back to me, and I wondered what was going on in the mind's eye of the people who were painting them. And so I began to look into the research on spatial referencing, Stephen Levinson's book and Penelope Brown and others. And so I'm about halfway through that paper, but I'm just suggesting that perhaps the Upper Paleolithic painters from about 15,000 years ago to about 40,000 years ago were what we call allocentric. That is, they didn't include themselves in an egocentric way in the scenes that they were painting. Doesn't mean that they weren't there. It just means that it's implied that they were there when they put their scenes up, and all the animals are seen from the side. You rarely see front profiles. So there are all these recurring patterns, and it's frustrating with Upper Paleolithic stuff because, as I said, you can't interview anyone about it. But there are recurring patterns there, and they are suggestive of certain kinds of cultural cognitive things that I think were going on with them. But I am speculating, but it's what I called informed speculation. That's kind of an oxymoron.
Well, the very idea of language to begin with, do people think, well, they didn't communicate at first and then language evolved? How do we study something that is so far in the distant past?
Well, there are lots of differing views on that, and you have competing factions within linguistics and evolutionary biology on it. One of the dominant figures has been Noam Chomsky. And his view is that language just kind of suddenly appeared, that it was a result of genetic and neurological emergent capacities in the human brain. More recently, that model has shifted, and more people are suggesting that culture and language are really two kind of different manifestations of the same capacity to symbolize. And once humans begin to depend upon symbolic information and passing it on, then language is just another manifestation of cultural tradition. You're just passing that information down. It wasn't some sudden evolutionary event that occurred, but it's incremental, more gradual. With that, the assumption is that syntax or grammar becomes complex, just like social organization becomes complex over time. And I think Chomsky's model, there are a lot of people who still hold on to it for dear life. But
well, Chomsky is such an icon.
Yeah, he's a big figure, you know, but it is changing. And there's a lot of cross-cultural, cross-linguistic data that suggests that what people were claiming to be grammatical universals, that's not so. There are too many negative instances.
I went to a bookstore in France, and the bookstore owner was so delighted that I was interested in a book in Noam Chomsky that she said, I'll close the shop and go to lunch together.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, he was here in Chico in 1990, and there was a group of us that had that were able to talk to him up in, I think it was Kendall Hall there on the second floor. And we got to ask him questions, and I asked him if he saw any analogs between language acquisition and culture acquisition. And he gave kind of a long-winded answer, and he's very bright and can really spin the intellectual ease. But he basically wound up saying no, that language and culture are fundamentally different. And that's a very different perspective from linguistic anthropology. We don't see grammar as something autonomous and independent from other aspects of language. And I think it's a different perspective, but I think the linguistic anthropological view of language gets to the reality of it more. I mean, it's hard to imagine language outside of a sociocultural context. It's spoken by people. It's massaged and manipulated by people across different situations, different cultural circumstances. And so I think linguistic anthropologists have a very different take on language than the Chomsky folks. It's just a difference.
Are we having to redefine even the term language?
Oh, most definitely. One of the problems is that it is a word, and we think of it as a thing. You know, it's language. It's like, this is my thumb, this is my arm, this is my nose, and I have language. Well, language is really a suite of capacities. It's not one thing. It's cognition. It's your vocal system. It's knowledge that you've acquired and built upon. And you can hear differences if you just travel around in the United States, you know, people who speak what they think is standard English, and you go back east and it's, that's my aunt instead of that's my aunt.
Yes.
You know, that's a small difference, but it's there. And I think we're discovering that language is not just one thing. It is a complex suite of capacities that humans can pull off.
My guest is Michael Findlay, who is an anthropologist who teaches at Butte College. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Michael Findlay, and he's going to tell us about taboo words. Well, Professor, one part of language study regards taboo words, because if we're studying a foreign language, we are not always sensitive to what maybe is not a proper thing for a young lady to be saying. But even within one's own language, what did you learn about languages and taboo words?
Well, I have a little section in my book on that. And basically, if something is stigmatized in the cultural context, the words that are used to denote that are also kind of taboo. And there's a tendency towards excrement, sexual behavior, body parts, but other things too, you know, the way people look. Ethnic groups, if they're a stigmatized ethnic group, you know, but it's so highly variable that people often get into trouble when they try to interpret working from one language to another. It's like walking through a linguistic minefield. You know, I think the PC thing attempts to deal with some of that, but they're very one-dimensional, and so they don't often go into depth about how some words are used in particular contexts. And so in linguistic anthropology, context and situational use is extremely important. In our own society, what I've noted over the years is that certain words don't carry the stigmas that they did when I was younger. And so you'll hear students say, I don't want to do that crap, you know, and that sort of thing. And when I was young, I would never say that, at least in front of an adult or something, you know. But
The TV program MASH had a character, Radar, mm-hmm. and this is supposedly taking place in the 50s, and he would say H-E double hockey sticks.
Yeah.
Because you didn't say the word hell.
Yeah, yeah. Or you'd say hectocopter instead of helicopter, and even though helicopter is something completely different. And so that's people doing what we call code switching. They're altering the way they speak and how they choose words, working from different situational contexts and different cultural contexts. The N-word is a fascinating study. I'll hear some folks say, well, African-Americans say it all the time. Why can't I say it? Well, who is saying what to whom does matter in a particular context.
That's a good example of that.
And you're going to get different points of view even within African-American communities as to its use. So there's complexity there. And so as linguistic anthropologists, we kind of want to know what's going on, and then we can be better informed about when you should use a word and when you shouldn't. It's a very complex but an interesting topic. And some languages don't really quite have swear words the way that we do. They might have some mild ones when they're talking about feces and other things, but they may not have as big a problem talking about that stuff as we do. So,
well, I even hesitate to use the word bloody.
Yeah.
Even though I'm an American, but British.
Yeah, British, yeah. But you hear it on British sitcoms all the time now. So, you know, even that doesn't carry the stigma that it did years ago.
Well, even among, say, if you're a Spanish speaker mm-hmm. and you grew up speaking the Spanish of Mexico and you go to Cuba or some other Spanish-speaking country, and you could make a faux pas because the word in your own culture, there's the culture again, was a perfectly innocent word. And you go to this other culture that speaks so supposedly the same language, and you could get in trouble.
Different connotative meanings attached to words like huevos and so forth. So, so that means you either have to make the mistake or you have to know what the local idioms are when you go from one place to another. And it's almost an impossible task, even for a linguist. But they do it. You know, I mean, they study that sort of thing.
Well, this probably is a chapter that interests students because that's often the words that young people want to learn first.
Right, right. Well, they kind of perk up when we talk about that stuff. And, you know, years ago, I would use some of those words in class. And then I realized that I ran the risk. I said it's like walking in a linguistic minefield. People outside don't necessarily know what the classroom context is. So I, over the years, I learned to back off, and I would say, "This, you know what this word is," you know, and we would talk a little bit about it. But I mainly kept it to the general principles of how words become taboo words in the first place, and why do we avoid them in some contexts and not avoid them in others.
My guest is anthropologist Michael Findlay, and he has taught at Butte College for over 20 years. He also taught students at Chico State, and he has written a couple of books that are pertaining to what we're talking about today. More recently, Cultural Traditions of Ancient Mesoamerica, and then in 2018, A Survey of Language and Culture, Linguistic Anthropology and Cross-Cultural Communication. Well, Professor Findlay, if you go to France, or you're probably going back to study your caves, but have you ever put Figeac on your to-go-to list in France? Because there's a Champollion museum there that mm-hmm. I just thought I'd died and gone to heaven.
Yeah.
Champollion, you might remind people
Rosetta
who he
Stone,
is.
Yeah, there are so many museums in France that every time we go back, we go to some of the same ones. And then others. We just finally got around to the Picasso Museum in Paris. We had seen the Picasso Museum in Barcelona, but the Champollion and
because it's a history of language and the development through just centuries in the Champollion Museum. Couldn't believe it, this little tiny village that has this incredible museum.
Do you know where the Rosetta Stone is?
Yeah, it's in the British Museum?
It's in the basement of the British Museum of Natural History, and Egypt wants it back, and I think it should go back. But yeah, I mean, the Rosetta Stone that was a lucky find, but it took an intellectual effort to really figure out what was going on there, and so they had Coptic and ancient Egyptian and Greek, and so they were able to, you know, just do the work. You just say this means that and that means this. And at first it was kind of a literal translation, but there's been enough time that we can look at ancient Egyptian hieroglyphics and study some of the nuances there and see some of the little jokes and some of the things that they work into the language. And you can tell whether someone likes someone or not, who was the enemy. And of course, if it was someone that was disliked by a lot of people, they would just rip their faces off of their sarcophagi. You know, so.
Well, I had a friend who studied curse tablets in Greek. He mm-hmm. lived in Athens for the most part, and he studied curse tablets. And I never thought about the fact, if you don't like somebody, you scribble it down on a tablet and throw it in the well.
Yeah. In fact, the word curse, we say, you cursed them out. It comes from putting a spell on someone, you're cursing someone.
Yeah, and in India, the Vedic scriptures, there are some that are for the upper-class people,
mm-hmm.
but then there are some down for the superstitious people who think, gosh, I need to have good luck with this dice, so I'll cast a spell and get this dice and roll.
Well, the elite
luck.
Populations can be superstitious, too.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the Maya writing is very elitist. It's the kings and queens and the scribes and the aristocrats writing about themselves, and they never mention common people. We have
that's
just
who gets
a few
to write the history.
Yeah. So
so you studied what the Maya had on their mind, too.
I did, yeah. I'm still doing that, yeah.
Speaking of that, I've seen pictures of this Mayan, and I guess it was von Däniken who said, well, he's sitting in a spaceship. You see here, his hands are on the controls. And what do you think about that? Because this archaeologist that I was reading about, and she was saying that the aliens didn't come down tell the Mayan what to do.
I'm on her side. we know what it is. It's the sarcophagus. It's the top lid to sarcophagus of a guy we can name. His name was Kanish Hanapakal, Great Shield. And his name is right there. His birth date is on there. When he assumed the throne, that date is there, and when he died. And he's buried there. And the scene that von Däniken has made so much out of shows Pakal himself at the moment of his death. There's a little bit of interpretation going on here, but we've seen scenes like that where the Maya talk about a person falling backwards into the underworld, Xibalba, and then eventually he'll work his way up towards the top of the world. And then the iconography around the top of the lid is all decipherable. And so what people are, when they say that, oh, those look like rocket controls, and those are either glyphs, out-and-out glyphs, or they're icons that we can identify, like Venus and the sun. So that the ancient aliens isn't doing us any favors.
Have you done much study of alphabet, speaking of these glyphs and how the Maya communicated?
Yeah, epigraphy, Maya epigraphy. They had a logographic system that had two parts to it. A logograph is a sign or a hieroglyph that would equate with a word, but they also had phonetic elements that they could use. So they could say, for example, the word balam, which means jaguar in most of the Maya languages, they could draw the head of a jaguar. And, as long as you saw a cat's head that had spots on it, you knew that they were referring to a jaguar. They had other types of cats as well, so you had to know what was what. But they had another way of doing it where it wouldn't look anything like a jaguar. It would be syllabograms or syllables, consonant-vowel syllables, and they'd be glued together in a way so that anyone that was literate could just look at that and go, oh, that's balam, same word. And so they developed a full-blown writing system. They could write anything that a Maya speaker could say.
Did these exist simultaneously, or was the syllabic kind of evolved after the
picture? Oh, you could move them in and out. Sometimes the scribes, if they wanted to be fancy, would take a lot of time drawing these and carving these complicated logograms. And in other times, if they just would roll the phonetic complements in. For example, I saw a balam glyph that just had the head of a cat with the ba thing on the front of his face. And so you knew ba, and then you saw the jaguar, you knew that that was just another version of balam, as opposed to our phonetic alphabet, which is just all letters and you have to know what they are. You know.
We're talking about linguistic anthropology and cross-cultural communication. And my guest is Professor Michael Findlay, who has taught anthropology at Butte College and Chico State University. When students take your course, what do you find grabs their attention the most? What do students find, wow, that's really interesting?
I think that most of the students, when they finally figure out that languages aren't just straight across the board versions of one another with different words, that they are actually structured differently, and that meaning can differ in the way meaning is conveyed can differ, that I think they have these aha moments. And that can kind of get overdone too. They can start seeing, aha everywhere when in fact there are some analogs that are shared among languages. But I think that's what gets them the most. That they just kind of become aware of how much variation is out there and by extension how much cultural variation is out there. A number of years ago I was trying to explain a particular rule that the Hmong and many other non-Western societies have, where if a woman's husband dies, she's kind of strongly obligated to marry one of his brothers. It's called the Leveret Rule of Remarriage. And so I happened to be explaining this in a cultural anthropology class, and the American students are going, really? That's what they do? And there was a Hmong guy sitting in the front, and he just sat there. And then so one of the other students asked, well, what if one of the brothers is already married? And the Hmong guy shook his head and goes, well, he just takes on another wife. That's in a traditional context, not here, but the cultural rules have changed, obviously, for the Hmong here. But the students that were asking the questions were being good little naive realists. They didn't realize that there were different ways of constructing marriage relationships in different societies. But when you hear it from someone that just says it right there in class, that saves me from having to just put it up on the board and say, here's the Leveret Rule for remarriage, and memorize this for a test.
And they don't have to take your word for it, because here's a live informant right there
saying,
yep.
Instant confirmation. Yeah.
That's the way it is.
Yeah.
Well, you said right now you're working on, what is it that you're working on right now?
Well, I'm working on finishing up the book on ancient Mesoamerica, Cultural Traditions of Ancient Mesoamerica. And that's Cognella, the same publisher that put out Survey of Language and Culture. Then I'm working on an article, but I need to get more resources on the Upper Paleolithic cave art. Some of the books that I had in articles were in the house up in Paradise, so I have to get around and think about where to find those again, and but I can get all that stuff. I just need to do it.
Well, thank you for bringing your perspective on, say, the campfire as an anthropologist, and for your fascinating studies of languages and cross-cultural communication.
Sure, my pleasure.
My guest has been Professor Michael Findlay, and his book, 2016, A Survey of Language and Culture, Linguistic Anthropology and Cross-Cultural Communication. Thank you, Professor Findlay.
Well, thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.